Okay. Good morning, everyone, again. My name is Carla Paluso, State Representative, and I am opening the informational meeting for the Joint Interim Task Force on Testing of Sexual Assault Forensic Evidence Kits. Today is Monday, June 18th. The last time we were all together was in January, just prior to the 2018 session. We have several important items on the agenda today, so we're just going to get started. So our first order of business is an update on the backlog and the Secretary of State's audit findings. We are hoping Captain Gardner will be here shortly. And Danielle Moreau, come down, please, then.
Good morning. Actually, I have with me Andrew Love. He's the manager on this project, so I'll let him start.
Wonderful. Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you for the opportunity to present our audit to this committee. For the record, my name is Andrew Love. I'm the performance audit manager for this engagement. With me is Danielle. She'll be doing most of the presentation. My job is to click. I'll provide a brief overview of our audit objective and a little bit on the work, and she'll walk through the findings and the recommendations. So the objective of this audit was to evaluate whether the State Police Forensics Division is taking appropriate steps to address Melissa's Law and best practices in SafeKit and to address their backlog. To conduct the work, we interviewed stakeholders, we interviewed staff and managers at the forensic divisions, we visited the labs and observed some best practices. We also did some national research to identify kind of what other states are doing in this area and how we can improve. And so she'll walk through the findings and recommendations, but I want to talk a little bit about our follow-up. We've vamped our follow-up process. Now we require agencies to provide a timeline from when they expect the recommendations to be implemented. And so our new process will be that we'll do an actual follow-up where we'll do some on-site work to verify the work that they did and produce a report on that. And that report will be public and posted on our website, and links will be provided to stakeholders who are interested. As part of that review, we'll also take a look at where the backlog is at that point. And so I will turn it over to Danielle, and she will present.
Thank you, Andrew. Good morning. My name is Danielle Moreau. I'm the lead auditor on this engagement. I will be presenting a brief summary of the findings, as Andrew just mentioned, from the audit and highlighting key points. All right, so the audit objective in this engagement was to report on whether OSP has taken actions to address the sexual assault forensic evidence kit backlog, or safe kits, consistent with best practices and statute. Our key findings were, number one, OSP has complied with Melissa's Law by increasing lab capacity and reporting results to legislators on efforts to reduce the safe kit backlog. Number two, OSP is following best practices outlined by the National Institute of Justice for forensic labs that process safe kits. And number three, OSP's decision to suspend DNA processing of property crime evidence to focus on safe kits could lead to a backlog of DNA evidence of this type at local law enforcement agencies. So I'll kind of talk a little bit of the background of this issue. In terms of the safe kit backlog, we can think of this in two ways. First, in 2015, OSP conducted a survey of local law enforcement agencies and found Oregon has a significant backlog of 5,562 kits, including 4,902 unprocessed safe kits. The second way of thinking about this is OSP's backlog of untested kits. These are kits that have been submitted to OSP and are awaiting testing. The legislature, local law enforcement agencies, and OSP have all made efforts to address this backlog. So as you all are aware, the reason for the statewide backlog was because local law enforcement agencies were not required to submit safe kits for testing. Discretion was left up to law enforcement officials. So in 2016, Melissa's Law and an associated 2017 amendment addressed this root cause by giving local law enforcement agencies directions on what to do with the safe kits. Kits were divided into two categories, the anonymous and non-anonymous, as you guys had that discussion in this committee task force. Anonymous kits were collected From a victim who does not file a police report. Non-anonymous kits are collected from a victim who files a police report. All non-anonymous safe kits collected starting January 1st, 2017 were to be sent to OSP Forensic Lab for testing. The law also established the task force that we're sitting speaking to today, and also outlined responsibilities for those involved in collecting and processing safe kits, including medical facilities, law enforcement agencies, and OSP. It also allocated $1.5 million to OSP to build capacity. At the local law enforcement agency level, so what Melissa's law did not do is provide local law enforcement agencies direction on what to do with safe kits collected and stored before the law came into effect. So local law enforcement officials took steps to address their backlogs. Approximately 2,945 safe kits from multiple local law enforcement agencies were outsourced to a private lab in Utah using grant funds. However, since the FBI has not authorized private labs to enter DNA evidence into the FBI's combined DNA index system, or CODIS, any viable DNA results from the private lab are sent to OSP for technical review and potential entry into CODIS. Oregon law states that CODIS stores DNA results profiles from people convicted of felonies and misdemeanor sex crimes. A match in the database among profiles is considered a CODIS hit. Other agencies sent their backlog of safe kits directly to OSP. In an effort some local law enforcement agencies set up safe kit drop-off plans in which they would send 10 or so at a time. As Andrew mentioned, to inform our work, we conducted interviews. We interviewed agency staff and stakeholders, actually many on the panel here today. And also to gain an understanding of practices in other states, we interviewed representatives of and reviewed supporting documentation from forensic labs in Houston, Texas, Washington, Illinois, and Idaho. And now we'll talk a little bit about our audit findings. So again, OSP, as the title said, OSP has taken actions consistent with statutory requirements and national best practices to address the safe kit backlog. At the time of the audit's release, which was last month, we had actually finished up our fieldwork at the beginning of this year, so January. At that time, it was too soon to tell if these actions that OSP had taken would eliminate the current backlog. As many of the changes occurred really recently, and they were actually occurring after January 2018 as well. There were other things that the OSP was doing. In their response, OSP officials estimate they will largely eliminate the backlog by the end of 2018. So back to the first finding here, OSP has complied with Melissa's law by increasing lab capacity. OSP is reporting regularly in a prepared annual report to legislators on efforts to reduce the safe kit backlog. The OSP Forensic Services Division Captain Alex Gardner, who is on this panel, also gives backlog status at the task force meeting that we are at today. In the graph here, you'll see that much of the increase in safe kits pending at OSP is due to a surge in submissions of older kits held by local law enforcement agencies. So you see in quarter one of 2017, there's a significant increase of safe kits sent to OSP for testing. And then you'll see the pending safe kits has also increased throughout that time. Into Q4 of 2017. We were able to also receive some Q1 2018 data, and the pending also had increased. The second finding is OSP is following best practices outlined by the National Institute of Justice for forensic labs that process safe kits. They have clear policies for both evidence submission and prioritization. Also, OSP introduced changes in DNA analysis methodology to more efficiently analyze safe kits. These changes including adding robotic equipment, using enhanced statistical analysis software to improve analysis of complex DNA results, and shifting to what is called a direct-to-DNA method. The direct-to-DNA method is a key method for increasing the efficiency and effectiveness of analyzing safe kit evidence by going directly to detecting the presence of DNA and only including other steps as necessary. Prior to that, there's two units that really handle DNA at OSP lab. It was the biology unit and the DNA unit. So the biology unit would receive the kit. They would do analysis of semen or saliva, and then they would pass on that information on to the DNA unit. Now it's a kit with swabs, and so the bioanalyst will look at the kit and also the report that comes with it and determine which swabs are the best to then send on to the DNA unit for processing. So it's smooth, really increase the efficiency of that process. Increasing capacity. Although capacity enhancements and process improvement efforts described previously are positive, these efforts have come at a cost. Captain Gardner had mentioned this a couple times before in these meetings. Training new analysts, adding new equipment that need to be validated, and complying with new FBI requirements initially negatively affected OSP's ability to process safe kits. As you'll see in the graph, productivity hit a low point in the beginning of 2017. So that is the gray line there. The number of case hours went down as they were training newly hired staff were being trained, and nearly all DNA analysts were being taken offline to be trained on the new FBI requirements. There was a big shift there. So as the number of completed safe kits declined significantly, it has shown substantial improvement. So the number of casework hours has increased, and the, as you would see, then associated line there or bar, the completed safe kits also increased. And I know that has continued into 2018. All right. Also, in anticipation of the expected increase in safe kit submissions associated with Millis's Law, OSP decided to suspend DNA analysis for property crime evidence in December 2015, including the highly successful high-throughput property crimes pilot. And this program was an initial program started in 2013. It was a pilot project to analyze DNA evidence for property crimes more efficiently. Similar to the switch to directed DNA method, there was a specific kit that was sent to law enforcement agencies that were part of the pilot. They were trained on how to use it. George Rick, you're familiar with this. And they were collecting evidence using these specialized kits. And then it was these, instead of going back to the biology unit, they were sent to the DNA unit directly in Portland. And the process included strict evidence submission policies and limits on the number of samples that could be submitted for a given case. The pilot began with three local law enforcement agencies, and four were added by 2014, but then it was suspended in 2015. The hope is to reinstate the program once the safe kit backlog has been reduced. So other states and large cities take similar approaches to Oregon. This is what we found with when we were reviewing practices and policies of other states. These included prioritizing safe kit testing, outsourcing, and switching to a direct to DNA method. What we understood is every state is different, every agency is different, so they handled it. They had used a lot of the same practices, but they learned different lessons along the way. Though there were some differences, Houston, Texas, they published the safe kit performance information on their website, which actually now OSP is doing. It was part of one of our recommendations. And Washington, Idaho both adopted a statewide tracking system. Idaho had developed their own. I believe Washington, I'll have to check, but I think they chose one that was being used by other states. So the next steps, and this is as of January, many of OSP's capacity building and process improvement efforts had been implemented. They were continuing to seek process improvements. They started a Lean Six Sigma recently, and then they also they're in the process of acquiring a safe kit tracking system. And I know there was legislation that was passed that they would to help them accomplish that goal. They also, OSP intends to resume the DNA analysis of property crime evidence once the safe kit backlog is eliminated, as I mentioned earlier. They believe they can end it by the 2018, and there is a reason to think that that's possible. In 2015, there was approximately, as you remember, 4,900 kits. In the end of 2017, there was another survey that was done by Kevin Campbell of the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police, which he presented here, that he was doing that. And it was determined that there were 1,100 kits out there. And that was at the end of 2017. As we're into June, that number is most likely decreased. We had three recommendations. The number one recommendation was to post SafeKit processing status reports on the agency's website on a regular basis. Before this went to print, OSP had mentioned that they had started this process, and they actually now are posting regularly. Number two, examine available options for tracking SafeKits, including efforts in other states such as Washington and Idaho. We know that they had started looking at a STACS program, and then now they're looking at more of the Portland police model. The third was to create a plan to reintroduce DNA analysis for property crime evidence, collect information from local law enforcement agencies about unprocessed property crime evidence to inform future OSP lab capacity planning. And OSP agreed with our recommendations. And now, if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Questions?
Go ahead.
Senator Thatcher?
Oh, yeah, sorry, just briefly. You'd mentioned the direct to DNA program, and I'm not sure if this is the same thing, so correct me if I'm wrong. But when it sounded like they were streamlining, they were making these a little easier, and it sounded like they were screening some of these kits ahead of time.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any danger of missing something?
One of the things, thank you, Senator Thatcher, for that question. There is, so the biology unit is the unit that screens the kit. And there are, so they pick the samples that they want then for the DNA unit to then process. There is a system where after the DNA unit is done with their analysis, if there's anything that they feel like they missed or the results aren't there, then the biology unit will be flagged, and they will then review it again to see if there's any other evidence that needs to be processed.
Thank you. That sounds good. I just was afraid that they would just kind of set it aside because something didn't come up. Thank you.
Appreciate the clarification.
Is it Deputy Chief now?
Yes.
Okay, good.
Yes.
Deputy Chief Burke.
Thank you. So, the first thing I want to say is I want to applaud Oregon State Police. I mean, the efforts that they took in order to carry this forward has been great under their leadership, and Alex Gardner has been spectacular since taking over with State Police and what they've done. So I want to say a big thank you to Oregon State. That was a heavy lift for them. Mm-hmm. The program that we talk about for the tracking system would be the sex assault management system that was developed by the Portland Police Bureau and has been implemented across the country. Again, a heavy lift for both agencies, and they've done a great job. My question that comes up is, as we talk, there was a gap that was created from the time that Melissa's Law was first implemented until the amendment took place last year, and when we re-inventory our sex assault kits, I just want to make sure that we're capturing those that didn't qualify to be tested because they were listed as anonymous kits that now under the new definition are no longer anonymous. And I think the state is doing, they're looking and trying to capture those numbers to go back and fix that gap. Did you find that in the audit?
I know that they had flagged those that were part of that little gap period, and they were notifying the local police official, local law enforcement officials. I know that within the survey that was done by Kim Campbell, he had flagged some of those that might be in that kind of gray area or gap area, and identifying which ones or which agencies had those issues. I'm not for certain about the process that OSP has taken since then.
Okay, I think they reached out to the agencies, and we're trying to collect that number. So I just to address that issue, I believe that the state is in a process of trying to capture those numbers and then close that gap so that we don't have another backlog that was created based on the definition. So, mm-hmm. Again, I think Oregon State Police has done a great job making that reach and trying to close that. The other thing, I think, and I think DA Underhill is on the phone, but I think through the grants that they're involved in, they're also trying to capture any of those kits that were outside the counties. I don't know, Rod, if you want to address that.
Sure, thank you. So the update that I have, which is about 10 days old, so it's a little slightly 10 days stale, but we have submitted, my office has submitted on behalf of other participants and around the state, 2,964 previously untested safe kits. The report I got from 10 days ago is there are only 17 left remaining to be tested by the Sorensen lab. Chances are, in the last 10 days or so, those likely have been tested. I wish I was able to say that those 2964 have all been tested, but for sure, but I'm not quite sure. What that is covering, just to brief everybody up, that is all of Multnomah counties, all of Lanes, all of Marion's, and then several other counties that we received recent authorization for to submit as part of the DANI grant process and funded by the DANI grant. I had updated Alex Gardner with that information the other day when I saw him. And so, as I said, I think probably that all of them have been tested. They are then in process of working their way relative to those results over to OSP for CODIS level review and entry if appropriate. So in summary, nearly 3,000 of the DANI grant, that project is winding down, near an end. Good news.
Thank you. Any other comments from folks on the phone or questions? Hearing none, or going once, going twice. Next up on our agenda is a quick look at two measures from the 2018 session. Chana has an up. Well, tell us about those.
Well, certainly, Chair Peluso, members of the committee, thank you very much. I will say very quickly that up on OLIS is a handout from OSP on the most recent data available from April of 2018, and it shows pending requests, requests completed, and requests received. Most of the data there is put into is sorted by quarters, except for the very last data point. So there's a little bit of a difference in the numbers based on the time periods that it encompasses. But that's up on OLIS if you'd like to take a look at that, and maybe we'll get some more up-to-date information soon. Turning to the 2018 measures, we had two measures that affected this task force. The first was Senate Bill 1543, which was an omnibus bill out of the Senate Judiciary Committee. It had over a dozen different changes to different public safety laws embedded within it. Sections 2 and 3 of that bill were pertinent to this group. And it says that the Department of Justice needs to provide, to develop and provide materials on how medical providers who are doing sexual assault assessments can apply for funds out of the SAVE Fund. That's the Sexual Assault Victims Emergency Medical Response Fund. It also updates the statutes there to be in compliance with Melissa's Law, so retaining the kits for 60 years, et cetera. So that's in Senate Bill 1543, if you care to take a look. The second is House Bill 4049, which was Representative Barker's bill, which asks OSP to form a multidisciplinary committee within the Oregon State Police on a system for tracking safe kits. And it gives a lot of different parameters for this tracking system. And it requires them to report back to this task force by January 1, 2019, which requires this task force to remain in statute and active for another length of time. So we've been reauthorized to go for another 2 years. We have a final report to the Legislative Assembly by December 1st, 2020, and an additional charge of monitoring the implementation of the tracking system. So information on that is also available on OLIS if you'd like to learn more.
Thank you, and I think we can make that happen. I would hope those who have participated with our this task force would be happy to remain with us on this task force, but we'll see what happens with that. So thanks for that. And also just, again, another a little bit of a shout-out for the city of Portland. In one of our prior meetings, showed this great example of how they are willing to work with us to track and to do these things in a highly technical way that I can't describe, but I think we're going to work a little bit with the city of Portland and their staff on that. So that's going to be a good thing. So next, we have a presentation from two experts on certain issues in child sex abuse cases, and I hope I am saying these names right. Dr. Reisberg? Oh, I should have stepped with the first. And Dr. Borg?
Yes.
Thank you. Welcome.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm going to shift our focus somewhat away from forensic evidence kits, so I thought it would be useful to start by setting a bit of context by saying some things out loud that I hope are already obvious to everyone in the room. First of all, let me simply say, I assume with no fear of contradiction, that the abuse, neglect, and exploitation of children is a horrible crime. I mean,
Excuse me, doctor, we need your name for the record.
My name is Daniel Reisberg.
Thank you.
These are horrible crimes. We want these people stopped. We want them prosecuted. I assume there's just no discussion on that point. And then second and related, we clearly want the best possible evidence for those cases. That way, we won't get snagged in pointless maneuvers in the courtroom. And better still, with strong evidence, there's a reasonable likelihood that we can settle these cases without going to trial, saving time, saving money, and maybe most important, avoiding the horrible situation in which we have to put a young child onto the witness stand to describe these terrible events. And of course, I also want to make sure we acknowledge the flip side, namely that the number of false accusations is certainly not zero, and we therefore need some accurate way of spotting the false accusations, particularly since the penalties in these cases are severe, and so exposing someone who's not guilty to those penalties is beyond awful. Third, and now crucially, we need to keep in mind that most of these cases do not involve any sort of physical evidence and so are separate from a lot of the discussion that this task force has been focused on. Many of the horrible crimes against children leave no physical trace, and even when there is physical evidence, whether it's a bruise or a burn mark or a tear, we still need further evidence to find out who the perpetrator was. And therefore, and now we really get to the crux of the matter and the substance of my remarks this morning, many of these cases hinge on evidence comes from what the child can remember, what the child can report about the events. And so if I can now put these various pieces together, the question really becomes, how do we get the best possible memory evidence from children to ensure accurate prosecutions and to protect the innocents? With that as the base, let me now at last introduce myself. I am a researcher with a PhD in experimental psychology. Experimental psychology refers to the scientific arm of psychology. It's an enterprise that asks systematic and careful questions about why people do what they do, why people believe what they believe, using throughout the standard tools of science. I am, in other words, trained as a scientist. I'm not a mental health professional, and any claims I would offer you here today or any claims I would offer in training investigators or any claims I offer in testimony are claims that are carefully rooted in scientific research. Now, what kinds of science do we need here? Well, around Oregon, child cases are investigated in dedicated centers, CARES Northwest, ABC House, the Children's Advocacy Center, and more. You'll hear more about these centers in a moment in Dr. Borg's presentation, but let me just say that the interviews in these centers are guided by a protocol that has been developed in partnership between the practitioners, the people who actually do these interviews, and the scientific community. Everyone agrees without any debate that we need protocols that are rooted in good science, science that can tell us what kinds of things can we count on children to remember, what kinds of things can children not remember, what kinds of questions are likely to elicit good information, what kinds of questions or what kinds of influences are likely to erode the quality of the child's report. And in fact, there is a wealth of scientific research on all of those points. And the good news is that the research tells us that children, even very young children, can report on events accurately and completely, provided that children are questioned properly from the start. And I say properly because the scientific evidence is just overwhelming that children's memories can easily and dramatically be distorted by outside influences of various sorts. When these influences are in play, children can be led to report entire episodes that never happened at all, and they certainly can be led to report actual episodes in a way that completely distorts what truly happened. And I also want to emphasize the importance of questioning children properly from the start, because science also makes it clear that once a child's report has been shaped or influenced in some way, it is very difficult and arguably often impossible for the subsequent questioning to peel back these influences. To use the common expressions, this is a domain in which it is very difficult to unring the bell or unscramble the egg. Now, the notion of proper questioning, therefore, has to rest on research that documents factors that can, in some circumstances, decrease the risk of false report. That's the good news side of this, so that from a scientific perspective, we can give more weight to what the child says. And correspondingly, factors that can, in some circumstances, go the other way, increase the risk of a false report so that we need to give less weight to the report. I need to be clear, though, when I use the phrase false report, I want to make a very important distinction. Sometimes children lie, and research tells us that children start lying at a very young age. Some estimates put it at around age 3 for the earliest lies. Usually lies are just leaving out information. But in addition, we need to worry about cases in which a child is sincerely and honestly reporting what he or she believes, and so is not lying at all, but is mistaken. This is sometimes called a false memory, something that the child truly believes, honestly reports, but is just wrong. Now, I want to emphasize that false memories happen a lot, and they are not the result of some sort of defect in children's memories. In fact, just the opposite is true. False memories are actually the result of one of the great strengths of our memories, namely our ability to quickly and thoroughly combine information that we've gained from different sources. This ability is incredibly valuable for us. It allows us to integrate things that we heard about on Tuesday with things that we saw for ourselves on Friday, with other things that we figured out on our own 3 days later. Your memory combines all of those things, just as it should, in order to create a knowledge base that thoroughly and appropriately pulls together information from different sources. The problem is, we all pay a price for this, and in the process of generating this knowledge, drawing on different sources, we often lose track of which bits came from which source, and so we end up with a type of error that scientists refer to as source confusion. You're correct that an element was somehow, somewhere, sometime a part of your past, but you lose track of the where and when and how, and that's how memory errors come to be, the price we pay for knowledge integration. Now, everyone is vulnerable to source confusion, but children, for reasons I can walk through if you want, are particularly vulnerable to source confusion. And for the justice system, source confusion is a huge problem. In some research studies, children lose track of whether they actually experienced an event or whether they instead know about the event only because somebody questioned them in a leading way. In other studies, children lose track of whether they know about an event because they actually experienced it or whether they simply overheard other people, perhaps family members, talking about the event. In still other studies, children lose track of whether they actually experienced an event or lied about it early on and then across a couple of weeks end up getting fooled by their own lie. Now, because of influences like these, memory errors happen a lot, and as I said, we can easily document cases in which people, and children certainly, remember entire episodes, including criminal episodes, that never happened at all. And in some settings, the frequency of these errors is astonishingly high. If you like, we can talk later about studies in which 80 and 90% of the children demonstrate false memories. We're not talking about a rare event. Now, I would love to say more, much more, about how these studies unfold so that I can show off the power of our science and so that you can see all of the steps of quality control that have to be in place before science takes any of these claims seriously. But I realize that time is limited, so I'll save all of that, fascinating though it is, for some other day. Let me step instead to the practical suggestions that come out of this work, because I hope that's going to be what's most useful to the task force. I've already given you the key ideas, namely that children need to be questioned properly, and they need to be questioned properly from the start. So with that base, let me say that a lot of the questioning happens at Oregon's forensic interviewing centers, and again, you're going to hear more about those in a moment. I will say, though, that the quality of the interviews at most forensic centers is quite good. The interviewers around Oregon know what they're doing, and with some side issues we can talk about later, they usually, not always, but usually deliver high-quality evidence. But I've said now several times that children need to be questioned properly from the start, and of course the interview at a forensic center, no matter how good it is, typically happens after the child has been questioned by parents and step-parents and neighbors and also law enforcement, and there's the problem. If those earlier conversations have in any way shaped or added to the child's memory, it's highly unlikely that even a fabulous forensic interview is going to peel back those influences. I'll say again, you cannot unring the bell. So, what do we do? Let me try to answer that by sketching for you what I think of as the ideal investigation procedure. Now, I race to say I do not think we're going to get to the ideal. Nonetheless, I think it's useful to have the ideal in mind, both so that we can work toward it and also so that we can use the ideal as a standard of comparison and trust a child's report more and more the closer it gets to that ideal. So in the ideal, let's imagine that a child comments that there has been some troubling event. Someone hit the child or touched the child inappropriately. The moment that information comes into view, I would hope that adults would call law enforcement. The adults should not investigate the matter on their own, although many adults try. They should not bring the child to a counselor or a conversation with church elders, although I've seen lots of cases in which exactly that happens. Instead, they should put the matter into the hands of professionals immediately. And for that end, anything we can do to educate parents on this front would be a step forward. Then, once the first responder arrives on the scene, he or she should ask the minimum number of questions simply to decide if there's some reasonable basis to think that there's something here that needs to be investigated. The first responder shouldn't probe or work on the details. Instead, the first responder should only take the fewest possible steps to find out if there's something there. And if there is, he or she should do three things. First, stop asking questions. Second, schedule a forensic interview to take place as soon as possible, within a day or so, and let us also flag as a point in which we can move forward is making sure that we've got the staffing for these forensic centers so that it's possible to get a forensic interview done as quickly as that. Sometimes it is at the present time, sometimes it's not. And then third, the first responder needs to encourage the adults on the scene to leave. I don't know what just beeped, but...
You're good.
Okay.
Yep.
The first responder needs to persuade the adults on the scene to leave the matter alone. This won't be easy because the adults will, of course, be filled with loving concern for the child.
And anxiety.
They'll be eager to find out what happened. But the first responder needs to, I mean, basically do a little bit of therapy with them to explain to them that they have to leave the matter alone and that if they ask questions, they're very likely to muddy the waters in a fashion that could create real doubts about the child's report and potentially devastate a prosecution down the road. I would hope that if parents understand that, that might persuade them to leave the matter alone. Then, as one last aspect of this perfect sequence I'm describing for you, I would want to add a layer to the forensic interviews because no matter what steps we take, the child is certain to have discussed the matter with non-professionals. And so, in the forensic interview, we really need to explore this issue, ask the child who he or she has talked to about the matter, ask the child how often these conversations took place. Let's do everything we can to find out if, or more realistically, to what extent the child's report may have been influenced by outside sources. Now, I should say that some police officers do exactly what I've just described, and so we're getting there. But I've certainly seen cases in which we stray miles from this ideal, and that's obviously worrisome because it risks contaminating evidence in ways that let guilty parties off the hook, and that's unacceptable. And it also risks creating evidence that sends innocent people to jail, and that's unacceptable. So how can we move forward? What can we do to approach this ideal? Part of the issue, I think, has to be parent education. I've already mentioned that. Do what we can to persuade parents that this is not a matter to be investigated by amateurs. I mean, parents know that if they find a bloody wound, they're not supposed to investigate it on their own. They call the police. They need to get the same message here. Okay. In addition, part of the issue has to be officer training, because obviously a lot depends here on how the first responder handles the matter. And on that basis, we need to give at least a little bit of thought to our statewide protocols. And this is the point at which I remind you that Oregon's Department of Justice does have a publication called the Oregon Interviewing Guide. The original version of this guide was largely written by the woman to my right, so you're about to get an expert view of this matter. The guide was then slightly revised for its second edition. And then something strange happened. The second edition of the Oregon Interviewing Guide was 230 pages long, quite detailed, and rather accurate. The third edition, in contrast, was 190 pages shorter. That is, it threw away roughly 80% of the document. And the third edition of the guide was not just brief, it was deeply flawed. It said things that were false. It gave advice that was completely out of step with the advice given in every other best practice guideline. It removed statements that in the second edition had been consistent with the science and replaced them with statements that were contradicted by the science and more. Now, I say with relief that just 4 months ago in February, the fourth edition of the interview guide was published, and it repairs many of the problems in the third edition. However, there are still many problems in the fourth edition. It's better, but it's still flawed. And let's be clear that the third edition, bad as it was Oregon's official statement for 6 years, from 2012 until 2018, for how forensic interviews should be conducted in our state. And we don't know how many interviewers across that span were trained with the problematic guidelines. We certainly know that during that span, the third edition, with all of its flaws, was often used in court to justify investigations that had, in truth, been very badly done. The third edition of the OIG, in short, put Oregon's children in danger. At the least, therefore, we need to think through issues of process. How did the third edition get to be so bad? What justified throwing away 80% of the high-quality material in the second edition? How can we be sure that the quality control is now in place so that we won't slide back to another edition that's just as awful? If Oregon is going to have good procedures protecting children in our state, we need to give a lot of thought to how this guide is produced, how it's revised, and what the process has to be to ensure high quality. All right, finally, let me acknowledge that nothing I've said so far is going to remove all the concerns. Indeed, in most, maybe virtually all of the criminal cases I've been called on to review as a professional, the problems happen long before anyone calls law enforcement. And so it's not obvious what investigators can do beyond, after the fact, trying to learn who's been talking to the child or what the tone or content of those conversations may have been. That's crucial, but it's also limited because usually there is no objective documentation of those earlier interactions. It's inevitable, therefore, that many of these cases will continue to yield ambiguous evidence at best and will be contested in court. That's just the reality. And here, I think we simply have to trust Oregon juries. However, I want juries to be given quality evidence, and that leads to my next point. The Oregon Evidence Code, passed by the legislature, contains many provisions to make sure that we do not distract or confuse juries with evidence that is simply unreliable. And Oregon has sophisticated case law that builds on this idea for some types of memory-based evidence. Consider, for example, somebody's memory for faces, the sort of memory that's crucial for identification evidence. The Oregon Supreme Court, back in 2012, in its Lawson ruling, laid out clear rules for what it means for ID evidence to be reliable and therefore to be admissible in court. In its ruling, the Supreme Court compared memory-based evidence, and I will quote, to, quote, other forms of trace evidence, like DNA, bloodstains, or fingerprints, the evidentiary value of which can be impaired or destroyed by contamination. Like those other forms of evidence, the quote continues, once contaminated, a witness's original memory is very difficult to retrieve. It is, however, only the original memory that has any forensic or evidentiary value, close quote. Those are the words of the Oregon Supreme Court. And that, those words in the Lawson ruling were specifically applied, as I said, to ID evidence. But from my perspective, from a scientific perspective, the issues are identical when we're talking about any other form of evidence that's coming out of somebody's memory, especially if it's evidence from a child, given how malleable we know children's memories are. And so I'm just going to look forward to a day in which either through statute or court rulings, we apply a standard similar to the Lawson standard to children's memories and make sure that we provide juries with evidence that meets some standard of reliability. Sadly, that's not the case now. Juries are routinely hearing about evidence that is, from a scientific perspective, highly questionable. And I think that fact is making the prosecution of these cases appreciably more complicated. And it also creates a substantial danger of prosecuting people who are actually not guilty of these crimes. So, see if I can wrap this up. In short, most cases of child victimization are, I think, investigated sensibly and well in Oregon. We are overall doing, I think, an extremely good job. That's the good news. But if you like, I can list for you some of the tragic and awful counterexamples, stories that make it clear that we could do a better job. Counterexamples in which somebody who I think is almost certainly guilty walks free of these crimes. Somebody who is almost certainly innocent is punished for these crimes. And I've tried to list for you in this presentation some of the obvious steps we could take in that direction, and also to provide at least a little bit of assurance that these steps are, in fact, based in careful, systematic, and reliable science. Let me say, though, as one last point, that, of course, some of the concerns here are outside of our control. Children will pick up ideas from schoolmates or from pornography that they find on the internet or from questions asked with the best of intentions by a loving parent. Those ideas to which the child is exposed can, the science tells us, become the basis for lies or can evolve into false memories. That reality is not going to go away. But given what's at stake and given the urgent need to protect children, I think we need to proceed on all fronts in making our investigations and our criminal procedures as accurate as possible. And I hope my comments this morning have given you some ideas about how we can move forward in that way. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you. And I do think they have you have brought some great information forward. So, Dr. Borg.
So I'll tell you a little bit about my background. I'm
Can
a
you
clinician.
State your name?
Oh,
thank
oh
you.
Yes, Dr. Wendy Berg.
Yep.
And I'm a clinician in private practice right now. I worked at CARES Northwest as a child interviewer for about 10 years. I was asked to lead the team. I was actually asked to write the guidelines, the first edition. I decided we needed a team approach. Then, as now, there were some controversies in how to practice, and I wanted to make sure we represented practice across the state. So we had a team convened, and we looked into science and different kinds of practice and wrote the guidelines. At that point, Oregon was way ahead of the curve, I believe. It was something I think we could be very proud of. There weren't any guidelines like this nationally or in any other state. Our legislature asked for these guidelines because we had a dream at that point that all children could have access to a high-quality assessment. At that point, children in some counties had access and in some counties did not. The legislature got behind that, the guidelines were written, funding was allocated, and now virtually every child has access to a high-quality assessment in our state. So now you're going to hear kind of another I have a dream speech, and I'm going to go way out in a scientific funnel and then way narrow on some specific things that I think we could do to do better in our investigative approaches. So way out, we're fundamentally social. This idea that children and adults are socially influenced is rooted in the deepest possible psychology science. There are volumes and hundreds and thousands of studies showing this. Attachment research. We're born so that we expect social connection. Babies who are not held and cuddled, high percentages of them will die. Babies stare into their parents' faces while being fed. We now know they have mirror neurons that are designed to read facial patterns and to learn how to be socially influenced by their parent from birth. That's why they're staring into their mother's faces. And they are learning very basic things. Am I safe? What does it mean when my mother looks upset? What does it mean when my mother is calm and happy? What does that mean for my well-being? Robin Fivish, then in the preschool years, talks to us about how co-created narratives occur between parents and children. Most of the studies have been on mothers, but that we basically define who are we, what's meaningful, who are our friends, who are our enemies. Reality is defined in a relational context for children. So it is no wonder in that environment that very young children are so highly suggestible because they are co-creating reality every single day. What adults tell them about reality and what they directly experience about reality are equally valid sources of information. Then, though, for a while, we thought, well, that ends. You're suggestible when you're little, and you're not when you're older. Anyone who thinks for a moment about their own lives will realize that's not accurate. I am here right now attempting to socially influence you. think about research on placebos. We do clinical trials now with double blinds so that neither the doctor nor the patient knows what the patient is taking. Why? Because we found that patients who got excited about a sham surgery, where nothing actually happened when they were operated on, got cured of their illness by a sham surgery at fairly high rates. That's how suggestible adults are. When doctors believe in the medicine and convey the belief in the medicine, the patient will act like they're better, even though they're taking nothing. They're taking a sugar pill. Political. You guys are politicians, at least some of you. The more times that something is said, regardless of the truth of the statement, the more likely it is the person's going to come to believe the statement. Suggestibility in adults. Bias is another topic that it governs some of what we have to worry about with children. Someone's bad, we think they're bad, they're capable of all kinds of bad things. When we look at them, we see them doing innocuous things, and we believe they may be doing something bad. An example, an early study, Rosenthal and Rubin, they checked themselves into a mental ward. They weren't crazy. They did nothing crazy while they were in the mental ward. They attempted to get themselves checked out of the mental ward, and the doctor had documented evidence of their crazy behaviors on the mental ward and wouldn't let them out. Bias, the doctor thought they were crazy. Thought he saw crazy behavior. Whole bodies of research on racial stereotyping, driving while black. So this stuff we're telling you connects to gigantic bodies of us being social creatures, us being socially influenceable. So now down to the very narrow. It is super important that we realize that conversations with other people are the main source of contamination for a child's statement when there's a concern about possible abuse. And that goes all directions. Conversations like, you're going to get our family in trouble, don't tell. Conversations like, I always knew he was a horrible person, and you know he also cheated on me during our marriage, and he's just that sort of a guy. Those conversations set the child up to remember certain things, to perceive certain things correctly or incorrectly. The first thing we want to do then when we have a concern of possible abuse is prevent the conversations if we can. Ideally, just like you've done with the safe kits. A lot of evidence was lost previously with rapes because victims didn't know that they needed to get right to someone to get the evidence preserved. And the hospitals weren't set up to collect the evidence properly. You've done very good work in that realm. Very much analogous, I think, needs to be done here. I wish we didn't have a screen interview at all. I wish we had child interviewers available many of the hours of the day. And basically, you're not going to get it. Luckily, because it's kids, you're probably not going to get very many disclosures at 3 a.m. Maybe you don't need them around the clock 24/7. But right now, we have a very cumbersome system where it takes weeks to get the child in because they have to have a medical exam and we have to have the investigative law enforcement officer there, whereas actually many officers in the field and at this point in our state, most forensic interviewers are trained to collect the bulk of the evidence they need. Get the child to an interview within 24 hours. And then no one has a chance to exert much influence on them.
Much further influence.
Yes, much further influence. Because in the biasing contexts, some like custody and parenting time disputes, for example, which is an area I work in a lot right now, a lot of bias may have already occurred. But in a typical case where a child maybe got abused a year ago and hasn't spoken about it, there hasn't been much opportunity for anyone to influence. We have some degradation of the memory. It's not going to be as detailed as it would have been the day after, but at least no one's contaminated it. But parents, very anxious, you know, they're going to start questioning. Get the child as quickly as possible to an expert. Second, if we're going to have a screening interview, as Dr. Riesberg said, make sure the officer knows limited. When I've trained police officers, I've asked them to have a little card with just five questions. And literally, just stick to these five questions. Tell me what happened. Tell me more. What happened next? If you have to ask a focus question, where were you? Just a couple of really basic questions. They don't need to do very much. If you don't have that awesome opportunity to get the child right in and there's been some contamination, the best you can do is assess the harm. And this is a place where, for reasons that I don't entirely understand, our interview guidelines depart from national practice. We corrected part of it in the fourth edition, but national practice is really clear. Because conversations are the main source of influence on children's statements, we need to know as much about prior conversations as we do about what's in the child's memory right now. So you start the interview by, what do you know? and you get as much about what the child knows. Then you go into, tell me how people found out about this. Who's the first person that found out about this? Who else have you talked to about this? Then, one by one with those conversations, tell me everything that you can remember, everything that happened when you talked to your mother. Tell me everything that happened when you talked to your best friend. They're not going to be perfectly accurate, but they at least allow us to track whether there's been any influence. Ask those same questions in the investigation early while people's memories of those conversations are fresh. The police officers go do that to the friend, to the mother. Ask those same, tell me everything that happened when you talked to so-and-so about what happened to her. Through those multiple sources of information, you can get a decent picture of was there any contamination. If not, great. You can really trust the statement. If so, what was it? Where was the contamination? What was the source? So the second piece, so prevent harm by getting them in. Assess harm if it's happened. And assess it from the child and any conversational partners the child has had. Now I'm going to really get pie in the sky. People like us. In my opinion, the facts should be neutral. The police, the child interviewers, they're just gathering the facts. Who cares if it favors prosecution or defense? It's none of their business. They're just gathering information. The science also should be neutral. Sometimes the science that we have to offer in these cases is highly relevant. There's been a custody and parenting time dispute. There's been bad mouthing of this person for a decade. Mom's kept a burn book on him, you know, of all the reasons she's believed that he's, you know, been a sexually assaultive perpetrator. Those situations we're not going to be able to do a lot about, but our science is highly relevant to help the jury understand why we're worried about this. Sometimes our science isn't very relevant. None of that happened. There's been no influence. But the science is much more likely to be misused if it's cited, if the expert's called by one side or the other. Even though we make an effort to be unbiased in our presentations, the questions are directed by whoever is on direct, and then that limits what's allowed to be asked on cross. And there are times when both of us have had things we could have said on a case that we don't get to say. So our ideal would be to be called a neutral panel of scientists, screened, vetted by whoever, the legislature, and that anyone could call that expert into the courtroom, and they're paid by a neutral source. They're called to inform the fact finder like an amicus brief. They're not called by the prosecution or by the defense. They're called to inform the trier of fact, period, of all of the science, regardless of which side it falls on. So, again, that may be, I have a dream. We'll see if that can ever happen. I realize that has implications for the structure, the very structure of the justice system. But those are the things that we see from our vantage point that we would love to see improved. So thank you very much for your time and attention.
Yeah, and if I could just add to that my wholehearted endorsement of this suggestion that we move away from a realm in which experts are called by one of the adversaries in a trial and are instead called by the court. Just to put some context on this, I don't know about Dr. Borg, but I probably am asked to participate in 80 or 90 or 100 cases every year involving some form of child abuse. And I hate doing it, in part because listening to the videotape of a five-year-old talk about these horrible things is painful. How could it not be? But beyond that, participating in the courtroom is also sometimes painful because if it's the defense that has retained me, I'm going to get attacked. And I'm going to get attacked in ways that have nothing to do with the science, have nothing to do with the case, but are just personal attacks against me. And I get it. I understand that the adversarial system works the way it does, but it seems to me that it turns what should be an educational, useful presentation of the science into something of a spectacle and makes the science less useful. And so, I'm not quite sure how to repair that, but if the experts had, as Dr. Borg suggests, been vetted by the state and were brought in as friends of the court, at least, I mean, we could move toward a situation in which the expert testimony is both neutral and also perceived as neutral. And let me just add two quick points on top of that. In most of the cases that come to my attention, I end up telling the attorneys, look, this interview was done well. I don't see any evidence of contamination. I think your guy should take a guilty plea as soon as possible. And so in very many of these cases, the expert input's going to be favorable to the prosecution. That's not what's happening now, which means we are in some ways underusing experts to prosecute these cases. That seems to me just slowing down the courts, making the courts less efficient. And then beyond that, I might also say that in the vast majority of cases that I get, I suspect the same is true for Dr. Borg, the cases involve indigent defendants, and therefore the expense of the case is paid for
by the state.
By the state government. And so if we move this to a panel of neutral experts, the added cost to the state might very well be zero, because all we're doing is taking the expense out of the Indigent Defense Office and moving it to a different branch. I understand the deep complexities of shuffling funds from one budget category to the next. I'm not going to pretend that's an easy operation, but in terms of the bottom line, the cost for the experts would be, I think, unchanged. And let's also add that I believe that this process would abbreviate trials, which would save time, save money. And so,
yeah, lead to earlier resolution of cases. So to put a point on what he said, we very frequently say to the defense person who calls us most often, and we're both open to being called by prosecution, by the way, it's just who rings our phone, and this has nothing to do with us.
Yeah.
But in those cases where we say, sorry, we can't help you, it's buried. Because we get called by the defense, and then it's privileged. And so it doesn't come to light that we said, this is a well-done investigation, a well-done interview. There's no reason to doubt this report. The trial goes forward, and no one hears. That does not come to light.
Wow.
So there's many flaws with that part of the system. So anyway, any questions? Thank you for...
This has been...
It's fascinating.
Oh, anyone on the phone still with us? This has been fascinating. Exactly. Amazing. Those flaws are really... importantly done bad. I mean, it's...
Again, the facts of the case and the science should be neutral. They, in fact, are neutral. The scientific process in this arena has been a beautiful example of, we say, I was present during this era. Children wouldn't lie about sex abuse. Then science comes up and says, well, they're not usually lying about it. They're confused or mistaken. Here's all the reasons they're confused or mistaken. But here's places where they don't get confused or mistaken. If you get to them right after the event occurred, even a four-year-old child won't go along with suggestions by an adult. So it's like, no, I was just in there when that happened. It didn't happen that way. So we know what their strengths are, and we know what their weaknesses are.
Go ahead.
Do any other states follow that protocol, Dr. Berg? What you're suggesting with the neutral panel of experts?
Yes.
Where is that done? I would like to know how
I don't
go
know
about
if
that.
It's done anywhere. That's why I said it's really pie in the sky.
Oh, okay. So there aren't other states necessarily.
There's a sort of a version of it, I think, in appellate courts with amicus briefs.
Okay.
And that would be the role model that's probably in both of our minds. Another thing I forgot to say that I intended to say. This may be somewhat ironic coming from me, who led the team writing the first version of the Oregon interview guidelines. We're ready to be done with them. That's my opinion. There's national protocols that are superior, that didn't have the flaws of the third edition of the OIG. And the second edition of the OIG also had flaws. There was research. The first version was written in 1998 and 1999. a lot of research had not come out about questioning that was very critical. That research came out in the early 2000s, mostly from Michael Lamb and colleagues. The 2004 edition didn't include that research. So Oregon went from being ahead to being behind. Then in the 2012 edition, we updated on that questioning research very well and very nicely. But then we went backwards on some aspects of memory research. So right at this point, Oregon did a good thing. There weren't protocols. We needed protocols. The legislature needed accountability if they were going to give funds. It was a very good thing. Yeah. But now we have national protocols, and it's time to line up behind those national protocols because they are strongly research-driven.
So I guess my question is, what's preventing us from doing that? Were these protocols, are they in statute where this has to be followed, the Oregon interviewing guide? Is that in statute?
It might be. I don't
know. So I'm wondering, what does it take a law to move us to the national protocols, or
I'll find out.
Okay.
Actually, if I can answer both your earlier question, Senator Thatcher, and also comment on this. Certainly, for other forms of memory-based evidence, other states have taken the step of saying we need to get away from the adversarial model, and have appointed special masters to collect and review the evidence and make the evidence available to the courts. In some ways, Oregon did a version of that. For example, the Lawson ruling, which I mentioned earlier, has a very lengthy appendix in which they take notice of the science as a way of saying, let's stop quibbling about this. Let's acknowledge the science. Let's acknowledge how useful the science is and go forward. And so even though I don't know of any states that have done this for child investigations, but there certainly is a precedent for other forms of memory-based evidence. And from a scientific perspective, to put it bluntly, memory is memory. And the precautions you need for one type of memory are the same as the precautions you need for other types of memory. So
eyewitness ID versus children's memories
so
of abuse.
That's the a response to your question about what have other states done. You asked, why do we have an Oregon interviewing guides? I believe every version of the guide has made it clear how important it is to have local guidelines tuned to local situations. And I assume that's the rationale for Oregon having its own guidelines separate from others. But to be quite honest, I don't understand that argument at all. Memory works the same way in Oregon as it does in Tennessee, as it does in
Israel,
and
England.
I mean, some of the protocols are in fact international. Michael Lamb, a major figure in this domain, is back and forth between Israel, England, and the U.S.
The entire nations of Israel and England long ago adopted the NICH, National Institute of Child Health and Human Development Protocol. So LAM is now housed in the National Institute of Mental Health, NICHD branch of it. I think he's doing some work on getting our protocols national. That'll probably take a little while. But Israel and England, at least we know of, have adopted the protocol for their entire nation, and their interviewers are all trained throughout the nation on one protocol. And some of the high-quality research on how to do an interview well comes from those nations because they have total control over the fact-gathering process, and it's very well done.
But, I mean, notice that what you're hearing from both of us is that if there's a push toward ditching the Oregon guidelines, the pushback is predictable, and the pushback is going to be, we need local control. And what you're hearing from both Dr. Borg and from me is receive that argument with some skepticism, because it's just not clear what you gain
by local control. What's the foundation
in science? And in fact, what the cost of local control is a document that in its third edition was scandalous, and its fourth edition is merely bad.
Representative Perluza, I'm trying to imagine this panel, this neutral panel. Okay, it sounds like it'd be really easy. I think it would be really hard too.
It would be so much
hard. But it would just be outside the courtroom hard.
Yeah.
In that
political.
You would have to yes.
There would be some politics.
Yes, you would have your who would be appointed to this? What's their political background? Their bias? Their education? Their belief system? And then who the people who were that vetted them? What was there? It goes down the whole list. So
by way of agreement,
it would be very.
I would welcome a fairly ferocious quality control for that panel, and I'm not anxious about whether Dr. Borg and I would pass muster. I'm pretty sure I know how that would turn out. But let me also say with some sadness that some of the so-called science on these issues being presented in the courtroom is junk. And not only would a carefully vetted, carefully controlled panel let us sidestep a lot of the adversarial craziness, not only would it avoid the deep problem of burying the science if it doesn't favor
the side that called you.
The side that called you, mm-hmm. which I think is just awful. Mm-hmm. The panel would also help us to filter out some of the junk that's currently being offered in the courtroom. So just, I think you're right that, I mean, the devil's in the details. Getting this set up would be colossally difficult. But I think on just point after point after point, it would move us forward.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I would just say, I mean, from a law enforcement perspective, a lot of the things that you have said, I think, are really supported. We see court rulings that talk about memory issues and then protocols that change as a result of how to do our witness IDs and things like that have been very strong throughout the state of Oregon, led by our county DAs who have helped establish protocols in those areas. I don't know if Rod's still on the phone, but I know Multnomah County was very strong in moving those protocols to follow the guidelines that were created by trials.
Yeah.
I also strongly agree that child sex cases, child abuse cases are significantly different than adult cases, and the types of investigations and the skills that are needed are significantly different between those investigators who take on those roles. And I know that, at least with the city of Salem, our investigators are actually forensically trained, which isn't necessarily common in law enforcement agencies to have forensic training. I mean, it is, but it isn't. It's not, like, overly abundant. So I like to see that. I like to see the multidisciplinary approach. Obviously, the state of Oregon is very strong in the MDTs, whether it be Liberty House or CARES or whichever place we're going to do those assessments. I think Oregon has come a long way.
Yes.
And as you indicated, huge. was a leader in going that direction. And I think hearing what you have to say will continue. Oregon has a tradition of taking on leadership roles, and I think we'll continue to take a role in trying to move to best practice.
And if I may, I agree
Thank you.
With most of what you said, including the praise for how Oregon has handled these cases until recently. Mm-hmm. But if I may, let me respectfully disagree with one point you made. It's true in many jurisdictions that first responders do have some training in forensic interviews. And I think the sad fact is we need to acknowledge how inadequate that is. And part of the reason is looking at the training procedures that Liberty House, ABC House, CAC correctly and appropriately insist on, based on the fact that science tells us if you're trained, you get it right for a while, and then you drift back to a much more natural form of conversing with children. And the science tells us that if you want people to be skilled, successful, high-quality forensic interviewers, you need to train them and then update the training. And of course, the trick is first responders need to be trained on so many different issues, given the complexities of their job, given the variety of cases they're going to run into. There's just no way we can pragmatically make sure they have the constant training, retraining, retraining for just this purpose. And so I want to applaud the fact that we're giving law enforcement forensic interview training. I mean, that's a really good thing to do. But I also think we need to be clear on the fact that it's not going to get us where we need to be.
The faster we can get them to a fully trained forensic interviewer, the better.
Right. I totally agree with you. And I think we're kind of mixing a couple points. First responders, I absolutely agree with you. One of the things we encourage our first responders, our uniformed personnel who go and take the initial reports, is to do exactly what you're saying, which is to ask very limited questions. To if you can avoid having conversation with a potential victim, then avoid that as mm-hmm. best you can for the very reasons you've explained. The investigators who do the follow-up investigations, who work with the MDTs, are the ones that we have had the forensic interview training and continual ongoing training. So I think we're saying the same thing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we didn't get to say this, but also we see investigators doing a really good job much more often telling the parents don't talk to the child afterward. We see in person investigators more often pulling the parent away from the child to have the conversation about what happened. We don't see that universally, but we see it more often. Phone calls, when the person's on the phone with law enforcement, if law enforcement officers could remember to say, are you in a room apart from your child right now while we're having this conversation? It's really important that if you can't talk away from your child right now, call me back at another time. It's really important that we not have this conversation in your child's presence. So.
Yeah, and in fact, just to echo that, I mean, since you're hearing in some ways gloom and doom from Dr. Borg and me, I mean, let's celebrate the fact that in the majority of cases, we're doing it right. In the majority of cases, these cases are appropriately and sensibly investigated. Yeah. We are not in catastrophe. On the other hand, given what's at stake, moving toward the ideal and repairing all of the errors has got to be a priority.
I agree. Are you, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm
go
just. Ahead. I am still back on this panel because I think it's an interesting idea,
yes.
And but how to do it. So I'm wondering, Shanna, should we suggest a task force, a process to develop the process for choosing something like this?
Senator Thatcher, I'd be happy to do some initial
or perhaps
research
we should do a process before we decide on a process.
Exactly.
For deciding a process.
Exactly. Yeah. Let's look at our universe and decide what might be possible before we go to the Senate President and the Speaker with a new task force on this. But maybe the outcome. We'll see.
Yeah, that's very interesting.
I mean, there is some process in place because someone's deciding how the guidelines are going to be updated, and I mean, we've been discussing concerns about that, but I mean, there's some machinery in place now.
Which I guess I was a little confused. So it sounded like the legislature back in, what, 1998 or mm-hmm. so?
Yes.
Said we want this to be developed, and then that ball was handed off to somebody.
CAMI office, Child Abuse Multidisciplinary Intervention Fund office. Was I actually came before you long ago, talked to Kate Brown when she was a legislator. You listened then, and again, that's why I feel very appreciative. You listened, and that's why now all of our children have access to a high-quality assessment. The dream that we had way back in the 1990s has been actualized through your efforts, and now we're here with some more dreams to share. But there's a fund that's created when crimes are committed, and that fund goes to CAMI, and there's a part of that that's earmarked for child abuse investigation, and a part of that is earmarked for these centers to have funding and for the guidelines to be developed. And so it was when we were coming to you saying we want centers all over the state of Oregon, we weren't saying we want guidelines.
Right.
We were saying we just want money, and we want centers all over the state of Oregon, and you guys said, well, we need accountability if we're going to hand you some money, and that's what started that.
So it's probably in the Department of Justice somewhere.
It is.
It was
okay.
In the Department of Justice, yeah. Yes.
So, okay. Senator, I'll send it to you right now.
So I think we are thinking the same way. You talked about the national protocol?
Yes.
Being in place? Or,
in ICHD, there are several national protocols, but actually they stem back to Lamb's research. Michael Lamb's protocol, in my opinion, is the most thorough, the most well-grounded in very solid scientific research. In ICHD, there's a book called Tell Me What Happened that has the protocol at the end of the book in an appendix. Hmm. It's very well done. APSAC has a nice protocol rooted in science from Michael Lamb and others. The National Children's Advocacy Center has a protocol. There's several national protocols that, again, are strong and in what we believe is a positive thing, not influenced by local norms. They're influenced by national and international research on memory and how children work.
Right. Well, and obviously they're putting the child first.
Yes.
And that's what's really the most important piece.
Yes. But our centers are doing a great job of that. It's child friendly. We used to go into these debates about whether it was okay to be nice to kids when you were, you know, interviewing because maybe you were bribing them, and that we don't ever hear that anymore because being nice to kids calms them down and they're more likely to give you accurate memories, just like you would be if I got you all in a panic attack and then told you to tell me about this hearing committee meeting this morning. You might not be able to tell me very much about it. Versus if you're calm and relaxed sitting with a colleague, you're going to be able to tell a lot of details about that. So, yes.
So, again, I support the idea of we taking a look at this and see where we go.
Yep.
This has been amazingly helpful, fascinating.
Good, thank you.
Mind-boggling. So, thank you for your time and being here. And somehow we will make something happen and get back in touch and let you know what we're thinking about.
All right. Well, thank you. And thank you for all your hard work on behalf of children and on behalf, too, of people who are innocent and falsely accused.
Thank you all.
All right. Thank you. With that, I want to also just, for the sake of the record, apparently Captain Gardner has been trying to join us on the call, but having technical difficulties. So I just want that on the record that he was with us in spirit, at least, and we'll get back to him with some information around what we are doing this morning.
Are we excused?
Yes, you are.
Okay.
Or you're welcome to stay, whatever you like.
Thank you very much.
So, any.
Yeah, give to him. He'll get copies to all of us.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So, well, I'll just open up the discussion because we don't have a lot of people here, so this will be an easy discussion.
Yeah.
Are there topics that we want to be aware of or should we be aware of? Any new development, suggestions for future work of the task force? I add this to the future work of the task force right now.
Well, I think it's interesting. This task force was tasked with kind of dogging the process on testing these safe kits. So it kind of surprised me when I saw this child abuse thing come in. So maybe this is, are we redefining the work of the task force a little bit, or?
No, I think in part what we wanted to do was make good use of time for some of us traveling. Sure. Traveling here, some of us being here, and I think it's been sort of a pattern that we add just something a little additional as something we might want to take on, something we might not.
Mm-hmm.
And again, after hearing this, I believe it would be something we want to take on.
Interesting.
But again, the right thing to do is to do some research behind what we all can do and that sort of thing under what level.
And so. Senator Thatcher, to your question, this topic came up after our January meeting. It was touched on there. We had presentations on post-conviction protocol and practices and wrongful convictions based on DNA testing. And at that meeting, it was brought up, there are other issues with this process.
Okay.
And so we said it that we would come back to that back in January. So there was a nexus there, but
right.
It does... it doesn't fit squarely into any of our particular charges.
Right. No, I have no argument with the fact that there's a relationship between among all these topics we're discussing. I just wondered if we had to do anything different, if we had to reorganize or what. Or since it's a task force, we can just go for it.
Right. There you go.
There you go. Agreed. I don't know.
So before we officially close, we did at the last meeting talk about a couple of ideas in this interim process or time frame, perhaps a tour of the OSP forensic lab, demonstrations or presentation on the Portland Safe Kit tracking system, tour to rural areas to learn about the SANE practices and hospital challenges. So I don't know that we need, I just want to put that out there if anybody is interested. And I think perhaps we can send maybe a little briefing on that to all who are on this task force but not here with us today. And if there's no other questions or comments, anything on the phone for us? Hearing none. We're adjourned.